We are straight up at 8 o'clock. It's the Mornings with Ed show on a Tuesday morning. And if ever there was a perfect day to have an expert on, it's today, as the numbers across the country are skyrocketing. And they're doing the same thing here in Orange County as hospitalizations and the infections rise. We've had 8,000 positive cases in the last 7 days. So with us, we have Dr. Anita Wong. She's a frontline worker, an emergency room doctor. She was the SARS team leader with Doctors Without Borders back in 2003, an expert in virology. And by the way, we are fortunate in this community that she has a practice here in this community. And we'll talk to her also about what she's doing to keep us healthy here in town. But first, please welcome Dr. Anita Wong. Thank you, Dr. Wong, for being with us this morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you
for having me.
Thank you. We last spoke with you just in September. And since September, the numbers have doubled as far as the national positive rate. We were at 6 million positive cases in September. We're at 13.5 million now. And we were at 170,000 deaths. And we're now, that's another 100,000 because we're at 269 deaths. 269,000 deaths as of this morning. So it took 99 days to reach that first million infections. And then just last month, we recorded an additional 4.3 million infections. And my question to you is, we're at best expecting to begin vaccinating yourself and other frontline emergency healthcare workers probably in about 3 weeks. If it takes 28 days after that first shot to develop immunities, you can't expect to have any immunities until around Inauguration Day, let's say. How important are these next 7 weeks in the country?
I mean, every measure that we're doing has been important from day one, right? I mean, that's why we have the highest number in the world, unfortunately, because we haven't been doing our public health measures as stringent as we could do. You know, it's always the same thing. With any respiratory illness, you're going to have what I call respiratory etiquette. You want to stay home if you're ill. You don't want to share it if you're ill. I know we have this machismo in America. We can do it. We can muscle through it. We can work through it. But in order to protect others, we really want to, wear a mask, wash your hands frequently. Don't touch your face. Make sure surfaces are clean. These are public health measures. And the one thing, my thing is that we have the technology to actually prevent and mitigate and reduce infections if we used a public health tool by a saliva test strip right. that you could test daily and actually know if you're infectious or not. That's the key, not if you have the disease, right. but whether or not you're infectious.
Right. So my next question is right there. Are you of the mindset that as we roll out vaccines, we should also be rolling out massive testing as well as the vaccine? It seems like they should go hand in hand.
Right. Well, we need a coordinated effort and we need to ramp up just like as if we're in a war zone, right? It needs a federal response just like you do when you're at war. And so we're at war with a virus, but we haven't had a coordinated federal response. And that's what we need. And because we have the technology, and what's infuriating to me is that we had the technology. It only took about 3 months to develop. Other countries are using it. Slovakia is getting ready. Germany's been using it. Poland, Austria, they're reducing their cases because they use a public health screening tool. And we can't wrap our head around whether or not this is a diagnostic and we're rolling out rapid testing as a medical device and a medical usage versus a public health screening, which are two different things. Medical diagnose the illness, right. but doesn't mean you're infectious. And these rapid saliva tests that you could have at home, which is like a pregnancy home test, you could test daily if you wanted. You could test twice a week. So let's say you test on Monday so you know you can go to work that week. And then you want to test on the weekend so you know you can go to grandma, right? right? And you're negative. Because it doesn't show, you may have the disease, but you're just not infectious.
Right.
That's the difference. And so coupling that with vaccines, with masks, with washing hands, without touching your face, we could really, really drop the curve down.
Right.
But so no one thing is the magic bullet.
Right. And people have been thinking that the vaccine will be the magic bullet. Now, first of all, in your wildest dreams as a physician, did you ever imagine that two separate vaccines would be at a 90% plus efficacy rate?
Well, I mean, if this had been any other virus, we would not be where we are.
Right.
It is because we had SARS that we are where we are. Because when we had SARS, they were developing a vaccine at that time. So there were already a few, don't quote me on the numbers, but I don't know if there were two or there were one or how many, but already in development, already in phase two when we started, when we came with SARS-CoV, this coronavirus.
Right.
So we were already ahead of the game. So because of that, that's why we were able to develop it so rapidly, because when we had SARS, they were already starting to, but then since SARS kind of died off, they didn't need to continue it. So they just picked up where where they were. And that's how we got so rapid. Now, the thing about the virus, these vaccines, is that they are new methodologies. So we don't know a lot about how well they will do because they're very new.
Right. So instead of like other vaccines where you would give a portion of the virus to the person, we're now introducing a genetic sequence of a part of the virus, which is different in the development, right?
It's very different. So people always ask me, you know, should I take the vaccines or not? Because there is all of this anti-science, health freedom people, anti-vaccine people, right? I'm not an anti-vaccine, but I am. I wear two hats, conventional medicine and functional medicine. Conventional medicine, without a doubt, I just say we eradicated smallpox and polio. Take the vaccine, no questions asked, right? But my functional medicine side of me always says, okay, what's in these vaccines? What's going on? How are we doing it? And so how we develop them is we put antigens in. We put mercury in. We put alloys. All these alloys are tin. These are not healthy things, that substances that we put into, that we want to put into our body, but that's how we produce the vaccines. Now, they do not cause autism, but they, you know, can cause other problems, right?
Right.
So the new technology of this gene sequence, and it's AstraZeneca used a chimpanzee gene, and what they did is they took the chimpanzee and the human had not crossed over, so they're saying that there's not going to be any immunological response between with the chimpanzee protein, and they took out the gene and they infected them, and they took out the portion of that DNA. So it's AstraZeneca is the DNA and Pfizer and Moderna are RNA, and they took out a portion of the DNA and replaced it with the sequencing for it to code in your body to make a messenger RNA to make that protein of the virus that your body can now develop antibodies to. I hope that was clear.
No, it was. So, and as we've described before here on the program, it's like that little spiky ball that's Velcro, and it has to stick to it. So yes, you were very clear.
Right. So that's the difference, and whether or not the safety, I mean, they are doing everything possible to make sure it's safe. They are not trying to make it safe, but we won't know until hundreds of thousands of people have used it. And their studies haven't gone that high. We've had, tens of thousands, but we're not gone up to 100,000. So, but the question always lies is that if you had one death in 100,000, but you saved tens of thousands of people, was it worth it? So, you know, statistically, everyone would say, yes, absolutely, it was worth it. But if you were that one person or that one person's family, you're going to say it wasn't worth it.
Right.
So for me, when I advise people with vaccines, so with the old ones, I say, you want to make sure they don't have thimerosal. So make sure it's clean of that. Whatever preservatives, no preservatives, if you're sensitive to that. Because if you know you're sensitive or allergic to any of those things, you don't want that. Or you have some issues with vaccines in the past. So you just need to know your own genetics, your own cellular function, how well you are. So as to me, I think the host always is important. So if your host is strong, take the vaccine. But my question always realized when somebody asked me, should I take the vaccine? I always say to them, if you don't take the vaccine and you get the virus and you have the severe sequelae, will you regret that you didn't take the vaccine? And if you took the vaccine and you were that one person that either died, let's say if you became paralyzed instead because you can have strokes, let's say you became paralyzed, would you regret that? So both of them have a consequence. Which consequence would you regret? And I said, that's how you have to base your decision, because I can't guarantee which one is going to be effective for you and which one you're not going to have a reaction to or a side effect. So to me, they both have their issues, and they're both developing, so for me, you have to make that decision.
There's a lot of misinformation about the dangers generally, though. Am I crazy, or are you hearing that same misinformation that I'm hearing about the dangers?
Oh, correct. There's misinformation. It's 100% that they are trying to make it very safe, right?
Right.
So the speed of how fast it developed was because we were already two steps ahead.
Right.
I think that there is an issue that what they haven't done, I'm not sure, but I think that they didn't continue the study after they found that became I think it was Pfizer Moderna, I could be wrong, but they found statistically improvement on symptoms and reduction in hospitalization. So they didn't continue it because those people who were getting the placebos, they didn't want to just continue giving them placebos. But I think they should have continued the study so we would know. The issues with Pfizer and Moderna are you have to keep them at 94 degrees below Fahrenheit and Pfizer, a normal freezer for Moderna. So for Pfizer's, the question is that is your pharmacy or is your doctor's office going to have a freezer that goes less than 94 degrees and keep it viable? So I question that. And those two do not prevent infection. It helps with your symptoms, reduce your symptoms, and reduce your hospitalization. Now, AstraZeneca's, on the other hand, actually shows that it probably will reduce infections. Okay. So your viral load is lower, your infectivity rate, your transmissibility is less. So it actually prevents infections.
Okay.
And the way that they did theirs, they didn't use a placebo. They used another vaccine. They used meningitis to give so that people couldn't tell if they got the placebo or not. Because the others, on the other study, they gave, saline or something, and they didn't have a reaction. So they kind of knew they didn't get the vaccine.
That's fascinating.
And the cost of AstraZeneca is going to be is a lot less than Pfizer and Moderna. Pfizer and Moderna is going to be about $20.
Right.
So other nations can't afford that. But AstraZeneca has promised not to make any profit during the pandemic, and they're holding the cost down to $3 to $5. And they could give, up to 3 billion doses. And since they've done that study that they showed that half dose was actually better, they could actually give up more.
Right. So since the individual here is not going to pay for the virus, our government would, from AstraZeneca, pay them at cost?
It would cost lower.
Right.
So, because we're already spending trillions of dollars. I mean,
right.
If we just spent another, I don't know, $10 billion for the paper test strips,
right.
I mean, we wouldn't have to lock down. We could go out. Our economy could thrive. If we're not going to have a federal coordination, we could have a state. Our state is quite, economically, we could support that. We could actually start doing the test strips ourselves. It's an easy to coordinate to print them out. Get them to everyone, get a packet to them, and you do it. It's 5 to 8 minutes. You could do it while you're brushing your teeth right afterwards. You take the test strip, you look and see if it's negative, you go out. And if the stores or restaurants say, hey, I want to do the test strip on you before you come in, you wait 5 minutes and then, you can go in and, eat dinner, but, you still have to wait 20 minutes for your table. I mean, it's a, That's where our coordination should be.
Okay. You mentioned a couple of things about the test groups. And Pfizer's test group was 44,000, Moderna's was 30,000, and the AstraZeneca test group was like 26,000. All of those test groups were adults. So I'm going to fold two questions into this one here. Most of those test subjects were adults. Kids will be the final test subjects for vaccines, and because of the substantially lower numbers of what appears to be severe infections in kids, they'll probably be the last to receive the vaccines. So you mentioned the last time we spoke that viruses always mutate. My question to you is it possible that once the virus starts running out of adult hosts because of vaccinations, that it could mutate and start becoming more severe and even more lethal in children?
That's the big question. We don't know if, since the virus is getting, we're putting the pressure on the virus, right, is it going to mutate? I mean, they always mutate, right? So, but once we start doing this vaccination, there is pressure on it too, because it needs to always find a host. And so there is that potential. And that's why I'm saying we do not know enough about messenger RNA viruses, because we've not had this around. This is the first time ever. Right. So we don't know the consequences. And that is just a theory. Now, whether that is will happen or not, who knows? I mean, because it's all theory at this point. But yes, it in theory, it is definitely possible that you put the pressure to the virus, it's reducing its host, it's going to mutate. Right now, and the studies didn't do it, people with chronic illnesses or the elderly. I think there was one that did with elderly, so that they didn't do it with those populations. But generally with the seniors, they're going to have a less reaction because your immune system is not as vibrant as it had been, right, and so your reaction is going to be muted compared to the younger, the middle-aged or lower, younger population.
Okay. One last question about the vaccine, and then I want to ask you what you're doing here in town. That we know that as a frontline ER doctor, you're going to be one of the first to receive the vaccination here in a few weeks. But as a private doctor, how does the allocating of the vaccines work for you? Do you have to request a certain number of vaccines? What's the process like for a private doctor to secure vaccines?
Well, that's a good question, because I actually don't do the vaccines myself.
Okay.
In the office. But I think that you do, once you are on that list, they allocate it to each physician who's had given vaccines out before.
Okay.
So they know what, so you have to have a history of how much vaccines you've been doling out before. So if you gave, 1,000, you're going to be allocated 1,000. So you're not going to get more than that. But so there's going to be a limited number. I would assume that would be how it would be. It's based on usage in the past.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Okay. Now, about what you, and again, as I said at the top of the program, it's so fortunate that we have you with a practice here in town. You're the lead practitioner of wellness, longevity, and aesthetics. You've spoken globally about it, and your practice here focuses specifically on preventative medicine and strengthening our immune systems with nutrition. And in a time like this, how important is that?
Oh, it's absolutely important. I always say it's both of host versus versus pathogen.
Right.
And, the studies have shown vitamin D, you need to have, you can't be vitamin D deficient. Zinc is very important against some viruses. So knowing specifically your cofactors that were working in your Krebs cycle, I mean, having vitamin A is for the lining of your lungs. And we know that this organism, this disease attacks all of your systems, all your organs, your brain, your lungs, your kidneys, everything, because it causes clotting diseases. And the thing is that our therapeutics, our treatments, we know a lot more what to do. So that's why we're having less, some of the people who are being treated, we can actually do more outpatient treatments. So the things that I would be doing are, IV therapies with vitamin C, some glutathione. You can do inhaled glutathione, also peptides. Peptides are really an important tool that we use now. and actually have found that that is actually helping with people to avoid that that inflammatory second stage. So you get the first, which is just the viral symptoms. Then you get into that inflammatory. And once you get into that inflammatory, then you don't want to be hospitalized. And if you get hypoxic or having other issues, then you don't want to have any clotting issues. So you really want to avoid that. So there's a lot of things that we can do outpatient-wise, and they're not hydroxychloroquine. Other things to avoid you getting into that inflammatory. And that's what I do. So I do a lot of, once even after you do have the, COVID, there's many things that we can do to avoid you getting into that secondary phase of COVID.
Okay.
And you don't want to get into the long haulers. I mean, because there's a certain percentage that becomes post-sequelae, and they can, for 6 months, 8 months, are still dealing with issues.
Right. And since it's, since the time span is only ahead of us, we don't know how long they'll be dealing with those issues.
They've been 8 months. I mean, one woman was just, she was so happy because she was able to get out of her bed, right, walk to her bathroom, and walk back to her bed without assistance after 6 months. That was her victory. So it's not a thing that you want to scoff at and go get a COVID party and get it.
Right.
Because there is these long haulers, and they're doing studies on them now. So
I read an article where you provide the nation's state-of-the-art incontinence treatments. And Mike, I have a couple of questions. What are those treatments like? And are people embarrassed to admit that? And is it hard to treat people if they're not going to admit that they have a problem?
Absolutely. So my whole preventative medicine is, when I looked at it, from an emergency medicine eye, which is that I see the worst of the worst. So I see the consequences of things that are that people don't want to talk about. Incontinence was one thing. Nobody would really, very small percentage, would talk to their physicians about it, or they would just suffer with it. When they come into the ER, they would always say to me, "Oh, I'm sorry, I might smell," or "Excuse me, I leaked or something, or I need a pad or something." And they said, "Well, did you mention this?" "Oh no, I wouldn't want to talk." "Oh, it's okay. It's blah blah blah." So this is a quality of life issue. And when you go into a nursing home, you can smell the incontinence. So we know that this is not going away. This is just progressively getting worse. And then it's not just urinary incontinence, becomes fecal incontinence. So as people would come into the ER, they would always tell me, "These golden years are not golden. I have this issue. I have joint pains. I have all of these things." So that's where I looked, and there's a I look for non-invasive things, because I think that we do things that are non-invasive to the body to let it repair itself and stimulate it. And this is a treatment where you can sit on a chair, and it vibrates, and you get that sensation, and you tightens up your muscles.
Right.
And I also do that on the abs, so, because the core to the floor, having that strong core, it helps with avoiding have fragility, because we lose the 3 to 5% of muscle mass every 10 years from the age of 30. So you could lose up to more than 15% of muscle mass by the time you're age 65 to 85. In that range, and that's where you start to see those people with that frailty syndrome. They're kind of stooped over, they're walking slower, right, they can't pick up their bags, they have to use a cane. So you don't want that. You want to be able to walk upright, you want to keep your stride quick and strong. You want to be able, if you trip, your core will catch you so you don't actually fall.
Right.
That's why our elderlies will fall, is because they don't have that core to catch themselves. I have to say, my mom, I've been working with her, and I give her I compound specific nutrients for her that I know that she's absolutely lacking, because I test for it and I know exactly what she's not getting in her diet and what she needs support in. And I replace that with a specific compounded vitamins.
Right.
And she's been taking that, feeling better, feeling more alert with her memory. And she said, she was on the phone bragging to my brother and saying, "Today I got up and I straightened up the house and I swept on the deck, and then I played 9 holes of golf. Then I came home and I practiced my tap dancing, and then I did eccentrics exercise, and then I walked my 8,000 steps for the day, and I do every day. And then, don't forget, I read a book and did my Sudoku for my brain." So she said, I used to do that in just a day. Now, in a year. Now I did that all in one year. I mean, one day. So having your muscle, your tone, and she said she sleeps through the night because she used to get up every 2 hours to go to the bathroom, and now she doesn't need to do that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I used to think that the body sculpting was really just a thing to... an ego-driven thing, just to get better-looking abs, which it does, by the way. I noticed that it does have an effect on the look, but it's what you're saying is that it really, it's for strengthening the core. It's for helping the elderly walk better. It has value that is more than just the appearance of great-looking abs.
If your motivation is to look like, have a six-pack, fine. But my motivation is to keep you healthy and have quality of life and being vital. And so if, so a little vanity may help. But my goal and everything, all my treatments are actually really for health reasons. So the M Sculpt that I have is really, it'll help because if you have good glutes and you have good thighs, the quadriceps are important to help reduce knee pain. That's important. The core, so all of those things that I do is really for a preventative. I mean, it doesn't help that people also look better, their clothes feel better. That helps you maintain your weight, your mood is better. A lot of side effects that are that you don't realize that go along with that being fit and you just feel good.
Right.
And then not having to run to the bathroom all the time and being able to go shopping and, doing car rides.
Right.
Since we're doing more car rides, you don't have to stop as often. They're important.
Right. Dr. Anita Wong, how do we get in touch with you?
You can go to my website, which is by my name, anitawangmd.com. Schedule yourself for a complimentary demo, complimentary wellness assessment, and a complimentary discovery phone call. And you can have a complimentary aesthetics because I also do a tightening of the skin. Because once you've lost that extra weight and you got a little extra gravity hitting you, you want to tighten that up, you can do that. And my phone number is 949-734-0580.
On a very important day, we are so glad you were with us this morning. Frontline worker, ER doctor, SARS team leader at Doctors Without Border, an expert in virology, and a friend of the program from right here in town, Dr. Anita Wong. Thank you for being with us this morning, doctor.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right.
My pleasure.
It's the Mornings with Ed show. Halfway through the 8 o'clock hour, coming up at 9, it's the Personal Stash and Escape.